One of the most remarkable aspects of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is its unique history. Throughout the world, great stories from faithful church members have only added to that history. This program shares some of these incredible stories of faith, perseverance, hope, and inspiration. You're listening to Legacy. I'm your host, Nathan Wright.
He was an extraordinary man by any measure. He was an inventive genius, an entrepreneur in the best sense, a public servant wherever he lived, a man of integrity, a man who cared for the poor. He was a man of faith, one loyal to the Prophet and the Lord in all his doings. Above all, he was a faithful husband and a good father. He provided for his families both temporally and spiritually. These words, spoken by Elder Merrill J. Bateman, were describing Jonathan Browning, Mormon pioneer and American gunmaker. With us today in the Mormon Channel studio is Betsy Lee Browning, Vice President of the Jonathan Browning Organization. Betsy Lee, welcome to Legacy.
Thank you.
Would you please tell us more about the Jonathan Browning Organization and what it does to keep the memory of Jonathan Browning alive, not only for his descendants, but for the rest of us as well?
The organization was formed in 2005 when we celebrated Jonathan's 200th birthday at the Union Station in Ogden. For those that don't know it, the Union Station has the Browning Gun Museum right there at Union Station, and it's got the history of all the guns that he invented and a great display of guns. And they also show a video of John M. It's John M. that the museum is about. The main confusion that people always have when I'm talking is the difference between Jonathan and John M. And so I'll state it right up front. Jonathan is John M.'s father. And one of the main projects that I've done is when I was researching the Browning family, I found a home, a farm home that belonged to my husband's second great grandfather, David Elias, on Old Post Road in South Ogden. And we moved that farm home and founded a home at Fort Buenaventura. And so they've completely restored that farm home. That's been our biggest project that we've done. We're also having another celebration on the Saturday before the 24th of July, the 23rd, because the 24th is on a Sunday. So we're having another Jonathan Browning Association gathering at Fort Buenaventura to dedicate this home.
Very good. You have the last name Browning, Betsy Lee Browning. What is your connection with the Browning family? Tell me all about this.
My history is I'm a Neuhauser. It's my maiden name, and I'm a convert to the church, raised in Oregon. And I married Devin Browning, who Jonathan is his third great-grandfather. And Jonathan has played a great role in our lives. We've done a lot of activities involving Jonathan, and I've been able to visit many of the places that he lived. In around 2000, my husband was the same age as Jonathan crossing the plains, and he decided he was going to make a trip on his bicycle from Nauvoo to Ogden.
Wow.
So for the next three vacations, we accomplished that, and he rode sometimes 100 miles a day up mountain passes, and I was the sag wagon. I pulled the trailer, and I've been back to Tennessee and roamed the hills where Jonathan's and Edmund's first farm was. And I've been to another town that he lived in next to Quincy. And I've been to Nauvoo, of course, many times and visited his home there.
Wow. So let's go back to the roots of the Browning family. You mentioned he was born in Tennessee. Let's talk about that a little bit.
His father's name was Edmund, and his mother's name was Sarah Barbara Allen Browning. And they were farmers at a place. Edmund bought a farm in 1808 at Brushy Fork near Bledsoe Creek in Tennessee. Beautiful spot, rolling hills. There's still woods there. There's remnants of the old highway that their house was by, but there is actually no remnants of the family living there anymore. I found the original farm, visited, and I got permission to wander around in the woods. And they think there might be a few rocks that might have been the foundation of their cabin at one time. His father was a farmer, large family, and was having a really hard time surviving. And I think Jonathan decided from an early age that he did not want to be a farmer, that the existence was too hard. He wanted to do something else. So the neighbor had a gun that wasn't functioning, and Jonathan went to him and said, "I'll work for you for a week on your farm in exchange for that gun." And they say that's the only week he ever did with enthusiastic farming. And so he took the gun and fixed it and sold it back to the neighbor for $4. And that was his calling right there. He knew that was his calling. So what he did was he had a friendly neighbor that was a blacksmith, and he went to the neighbor and did his chores early in the morning and late at night and spent the time with the neighbor during the day and learned the blacksmith trade. And the neighbor taught him everything that he knew, but Jonathan saw a gun with the name Samuel Porter Nashville on it, and decided he needed to go to Nashville to learn how to make a real gun. He couldn't make the barrels, and so he needed to learn how to make barrels. So he got on borrowed a horse of his father's, rode to Nashville, and didn't even tell Samuel he was coming. He just showed up at his door and said, "I'd like to apprentice with you for no charge, and learn the trade of, you know, how to be a gunsmith." And Samuel was evidently a good guy and took him in and found out that he had that he liked Jonathan. He taught him everything he knew, and at the end of 3 months, he offered Jonathan a partnership in his business. But Jonathan had a girlfriend near Brushy Fork, Elizabeth Stalkup. She lived in Gallatin, and she had long brown hair, and he was wanting to get married to her. So he got the Samuel Porter did give him some money, and he bought some extra tools to take back with him. So he went back and he married Elizabeth, and her father was deceased at the time. And her mother, Barbary, was living in Gallatin, but they ended up in near Nashville, about 11 miles from Nashville, and they started their family there.
So he came back from this very successful time learning to be a gunsmith, started his own shop, but they didn't live very long in the Brushy Fork area. What precipitated moving away?
His wife was from Nashville originally. And that's why they decided to move out to Nashville, because her family was out there. His family remained in Brushy Fork until 1831, when his father sold the farm and moved to the southern tip of Illinois, and joined his family eventually joined him in a little town called Fairfield. And Edmund died in Fairfield in 1833. And then Jonathan joined the family there in 1834 and remained there for a short time before moving to a little town called La Prairie in Adams County, Illinois.
And both these towns are fairly close to another town that most people will recognize.
La Prairie is 35 miles northeast of Quincy, and Jonathan's farm was 11 miles northeast of La Prairie. So he wasn't exactly in La Prairie, but he could ride horseback from his farm to Quincy in a day's time.
So here, let's talk about the Illinois/Quincy years. He set up another gun shop, of course.
Yes. He set a gun shop up in his farm in La Prairie. Okay. That would have been, he had one in Brushy Fork, so that would have been his second gun shop. I'm not an expert on the guns, and I have to say that up front. If I said something about the guns, I'd probably say it wrong. So I do know that he invented a slider gun, a slider rifle. And the rifles that he was probably fixing for other people were the Kentucky rifle. And he was an inventor of sorts himself. He was trying to improve guns and make them simpler, more functional, so that they could shoot repeatedly.
And so he was successful as a repairman of firearms, but he He wanted to stretch a little bit, and he started inventing things, is what it sounds like.
He was also involved in, he did blacksmithing jobs still. He did some farming. He did some animal, you know, raised animals. Jonathan did not like idle children, especially idle boys. And so he had a lot of businesses in his lifetime to keep his children, his boys, busy. He figured if they were busy, they couldn't get in trouble. And so he employed, it wasn't really for his financial gain, although I'm sure it helped, but it was more to mold their character.
Very good. So in the Illinois years, he as he became more successful, he became more respected and got some prominence in the community.
Yes. In most of the communities that Jonathan lived in, with I think the exception of Brushy Fork, he was justice of the peace. He was very civic-minded, and the name that people called him was either Squire Browning, which is another name for Justice of the Peace, or Judge Browning. And being Justice of the Peace, he could take care of some of the lower case, you know, court cases, and he could perform marriages, and he could turn people over for trial. And so he was prominent in the communities and well-liked.
You said that a lot of his family came to Illinois at the same time. What were some of the other, who were some of the other family members that lived around there?
Well, Clarissa is the one I think that first moved into the southern tip. And Edmund and his wife, Sarah Barbara, went and lived there. But Jonathan was very close with his brother James Green, his youngest brother. And they formed a lifelong attachment to each other. James was always sent ahead of the group to kind of procure the farmlands. And James was a farmer for most of his life. And so they stuck together like glue, and they were a very close family.
He had another brother, Orville, as I recall.
No, Orville was a distant cousin.
Oh, cousin, that's correct.
He was a distant cousin, and he was a circuit attorney in Quincy. And Orville and Jonathan were well acquainted with each other. And through them, Jonathan became acquainted with Abraham Lincoln, according to family legend. And in analyzing Lincoln's life, he was just beginning to be a circuit attorney traveling that western part of Illinois at that time. And Jonathan's home was far enough from Quincy that would have made a good stopping off point for this, for Abraham Lincoln to stay the night.
This was a young Abraham Lincoln.
This was a young, way before he was president, and he was just in his beginning years as an attorney. The family have tales of them yarning together is what they call it, and they sit down and talk. And the fact exists that most likely Abraham Lincoln did stay twice at Jonathan's home in La Prairie.
It was about this time that members of the church were booted out of Missouri and started basically flooding into Illinois. What was Jonathan's role in welcoming the members of the church? Do we know?
I think Quincy was in the beginning very favorable to the exodus of the saints and tried to help them, seeing their dire straits. And Jonathan, being justice of the peace, was well known in the time, and he had heard about the Mormons. And there are a couple stories of how he actually learned about the church, but we don't know which one is exactly, but someone introduced him to the church, and later he was able to meet the prophet Joseph. But I do think the turning point in his conversion was the Book of Mormon. And once Jonathan converted to the church, he was a full convert. He did everything in his power to progress the church in that area. And eventually, he left his farm in La Prairie in charge of his brother, James Green, who lived nearby him, and proceeded to go to Nauvoo to join the saints. And James Green always remained out there on the farm by La Prairie and over the, you know, supervising the two farms. And Jonathan rented for a short time period in Nauvoo, and then he bought a house from James Benjamin Bird and James had just had a log cabin in Nauvoo, and he had just finished 3 months earlier a two-story, very nice house in Nauvoo for the time period. And so Jonathan bought this property from Benjamin Bird and added on a gun shop on the left side of the house and proceeded to do his gunsmithing and his and he helped a lot in the economy of Nauvoo, because many people that were in Nauvoo were poor and the economy was struggling, and having this business of gunsmithing really helped the economy.
Very good. This is Legacy on the Mormon Channel. We're visiting with Betsy Lee Browning, Vice President of the Jonathan Browning Organization. And, of course, we're talking about pioneer and gunsmith Jonathan Browning. Where in Nauvoo did he set up his shop?
He set up his shop right there on Main Street. And I was listening to a former show of yours, and it was talking about Main Street and how it was just a dirt road at that time period, and how the it was muddy and how they had sidewalks on the side so people could walk. And so he was right in the main business district of Nauvoo.
Did he come up with any new inventions while he was in Nauvoo?
Most in Nauvoo, he manufactured guns, and his invention that he had of the six slider, guns were constantly improving, and so there were better guns made after that. And so I'm not sure how many inventions he actually did in Nauvoo, but I know as Nauvoo was a period of rest for him for a while and just building up his personal finances in Nauvoo, but his life was basically a life of work. He, you know, it took 2 weeks to manufacture a gun, and there was a lot of pounding and hammering to make that gun, and the price today would seem very small to us. But he had a lot of children by then. He eventually had 12 by his first wife. And unfortunately, he lost one daughter right after birth, and she was buried right next to the Browning home. But he was constantly busy, and I'm sure he brought his boys into that business and was teaching them, because almost every Browning knew about guns. Every son of Jonathan could fire, fix, knew the parts. They all were quite educated in guns. And so he had quite a few boys, and so I'm sure he involved them in the family business. And right before the Saints, well, during that time period, he was working on the temple also. So his life was very busy in Nauvoo, but it also, I think, was a period of rest for him too, from some of the worries and the stresses, until it started getting bad. And in that, he was very useful for the church, in that he was a blacksmith and could repair wagons, he could repair guns. He was very, I'm sure he helped tons of people with their getting ready to make the exodus out of Nauvoo.
Backing up just a little bit, can you tell us anything about his relationship with the Prophet Joseph?
We know that he knew the Prophet very closely, and that the Prophet used his skills for his own personal benefit, you know, like he would bring something down to be mended, and Jonathan had a extreme loyalty to the prophet. And I'm sure the Prophet knew him, conversed with him very often. And one of the daughters remembers, Asenath, remembers the Prophet being in their house.
Another little section of Elder Bateman's talk is when he talks about the Nauvoo era. He says one of the more interesting features of the Nauvoo guns was an engraved plate on the stock reading, "Holiness to the Lord, our preservation."
Well, actually, that phrase was passed down through the family and future guns by his children. That was engraved upon the rifles. And you have to remember that the gun was not really a means of killing people in those days. It was a means of preservation for hunting, for feeding your family. The gun was basically used for everyday life, and it was part of pioneer life.
As I understand from what I've read, Brother Brigham asked Jonathan to stay behind for some time in Nauvoo to help people get ready.
Well, what he did, he stayed. The family tradition is that he was his family and the Carding family, which married into his family, were the ones of the last people to leave Nauvoo because they stayed and helped the saints. And actually what happened, to back up just a second, after the prophet was killed, Jonathan removed his family back to his farm in Adams County. His wife was pregnant and near due. And so they moved back temporarily back with James Green and stayed there for a season and then eventually came back to Nauvoo before the Exodus. So for a short period of time, we don't know exactly how long or where Jonathan was exactly. Maybe he remained in Nauvoo, but we do know that his wife delivered a child back on the farm in Adams, and it was more of a protection for his family.
Sure. Now, once they left Nauvoo, they traveled across Iowa and put down roots there for a time, as I understand.
Yes. They ended up in... It was there was another name for it. It was Sarpy's Tattler's Point, and it was on the Missouri Bottoms. It was a half a mile south of a little village called Indian Traders, and they named it, the Brownings named it Mosquito Creek. Now, that name in itself can give you an idea of how nice the place was, but they did remain there right at that time. Brigham was asking for volunteers for the Mormon battalion, and Jonathan was right up there volunteering, and they had a line of men lined up, and one of the bishops at the time said, "You can't take everybody. You got to leave me somebody here." And so Brigham Young went down the line and said, "Brother Browning, we really need you here to help the saints as they pass this point, to prepare them for the Exodus." So he did a lot of mending of wheels, a lot of mending of guns, and his wife had another child there. At that time, too, it's interesting, Jonathan's mother remained with James Green, and many people think she died way back in southern Illinois, but she actually made it to Mosquito Creek. We don't know if she ever joined the church, but she was a very good Christian woman, and she died there in Mosquito Creek. Another one of his grandchildren died there in Mosquito Creek, and Jonathan was bishop of the area. There were a lot of other families in Mosquito Creek besides the Brownings, and so Jonathan was their bishop, and also provided for the poor. Now, an interesting situation happened with me. I was up in the Morgan Family History Center one day, and a gal came in, and she said, "Are you a Browning?" It was right after I moved to Mountain Green. And I said, "Yes, I'm a Browning." And she hugged me fiercely. And I said, "Okay." And she said, "That is for my ancestor, Andrew Jackson Shoup, because Jonathan financially took care of his wife while he was serving the Mormon battalion." So Jonathan was a very generous person and always helping the poor and the needy. And I'm sure there's other people he helped that I have no clue to, but Andrew Jackson recorded this in his diary.
So he spent 5 years in Iowa, staying there basically as a way station for members as they came through, helping with their wagons and guns, as you say. And eventually... was able to come west, farther west.
Eventually, what happened was Jonathan funded his brother James Green to proceed on to Salt Lake in 1850. Jonathan stayed there till 1852. And so James Green went ahead and purchased the land in Ogden and prepared for Jonathan to come. And so in 1852, the church announced that they wanted all their members back in Salt Lake. So... Jonathan had a period there that he could prepare for the journey. So he was very well prepared as he left. He had $600 in the false bottom of a barrel. He had many wagons, and he brought all his gun-making machinery, which was some pieces were very large. His kids were of almost adult age. 11 of his children were surviving, and they all traveled and shot buffalo along the way. And James Allen, one of his sons, records in his journal the trip and the things that they encountered.
In fact, I have a quote from his diary right here. He says, "Amid plains, rugged rocks, chimney, courthouse, and independent rocks, and Devil's Gate, for instance, Cache Cave, mineral springs, and many other wonders of nature presented to our view. I also enjoyed the sport of shooting the buffalo, antelope, prairie dog, a peculiar little rodent animal said to burrow with the screech owl and rattlesnake, and sage hens and other wild game." So sounds like there were plenty of things to do while they were traveling.
Yes.
And it wasn't just the Browning family traveling alone. He went with a wagon train.
Yes, he was captain of 10. We're thinking, we've analyzed that captain of 10 thing, and I think it was basically his family, captain of 10. And then with two adults. We're not really sure, but we do know that he played a leadership role in he was in with the Miller Company and Henry W. Miller Company and Orson Hyde. And they started in July of 1852, and they arrived in Salt Lake in October of 1852. And they had a very pretty mild trip, and there was no big incidences that occurred. And so it was a pretty smooth voyage for him.
So he gets to Utah and is asked to settle. Well, that's a question I have, is if his brother went ahead and purchased land, was it pretty much predetermined that that's where he was going to end up?
Yes. Most of the family ended up in Ogden. James had already been settled there for a few years, and many of the family lived around 27th Street in Washington Boulevard. And Jonathan, and they use this term loosely, set up his gun shop. By then, Jonathan, he was done inventing. He didn't invent it all in Ogden. He pursued other pursuits in Ogden. And I don't think he wanted people to know that he had this gun shop behind his house, because it was crudely made. Rough boards, it's just in his backyard. And he had come to Ogden. He had followed the church's admonition of polygamy and taken a second and a third wife. And the kids of his first wife were, by that time, they were marrying and starting their own households. And he fathered children actually till he was 70. His last child was born when he was 70. And he was very proud that he was able to father children up to 70. And he loved his children, was a great family man. But he was starting new ventures in business. He had a lot of tanneries, molasses mills, brick making, lots of, and these were basically set up for his children.
Just to keep them busy.
Just to keep them busy. And they, I mean, we even know that their horse's name was Old Button. And the children's duties were to, they took Old Button up to, they had to grind chips for the tannery. And so they took Old Button up to the, I don't know, what circular thing that they would ride. And the kid would have to ride him all around all day. And if he fell asleep, the whole tannery would stop because they needed these things ground. And so the girls were put under Elizabeth and their mother. And the second wife was Elizabeth Caroline Clark Weir. She had two daughters from a previous marriage. She had been divorced from Thomas Weir. And then she married Jonathan and had two boys and a girl, but the girl died young. And so Matt and John were of the Browning brothers' fame, were her children. And then the third wife, Ann Emmett, she raised a lot of children that became prominent in, the men became prominent in Ogden politics and mayors and prominent citizens in Ogden. And so he had these two families that were close in age the kids were really close in age, and they did not call each other half-brother or half-sister. They, between the wives, each, that was their siblings, and they would spend equal time probably at all the houses. Elizabeth was getting older at this time, and her family was raised in, and so John was one of the first ones to take interest in the gun-making procedure. And so he would spend a lot of time up in the old gun shop, the rough gun shop behind Jonathan's house. And Jonathan was off on other business dealings. And so it fell to one of the wives to help John run this little gun business. As soon as he could learn how to ride, he was writing out orders and taking, acting like he knew what he, and he did. He knew at an early age all the parts of a gun. He knew how to fire a gun. He'd created rough guns himself as a young boy, trying to, out of the pile of scraps on the floor. And those were his toys, and he grew up learning about guns. And when Matthew came along, Matthew was like his little shadow and looked up to John. And between the two, they became close and became close with all of their siblings that were from Elizabeth Clark's family and from Ann Emmett's family. And the other ones, they weren't as quite, they knew him and they were, you know, friends with him, but they weren't quite as close because they were off raising their own families.
We're talking about the remarkable life of pioneer Jonathan Browning on Legacy Today. Betsy Lee Browning, family member and vice president of the Jonathan Browning Organization, has joined us. In fact, there's a traditional story of young John Moses where he's pretty proud of the accomplishment of his first gun that he built, takes it to his father and shows him. And Jonathan is reportedly to have said, "John Mose, you're going on 11. Can't you make a better gun than that?" And it just seems a little harsh, but they were in the gun business. So.
Well, he had taken that gun, and he just had taken it for the stock of the gun. He just hacked it off with an axe. It wasn't finished to any degree. They had to carry a can of coals to light the gun to shoot it off. And they would swing it as they were walk up in the hills to keep the coals warm.
Right, right.
And so the first gun was a really rough gun. But then he got a gun from a man who did the shipping, wagon shipping, came along, and he had a gun that was damaged in shipping. And John bought that gun from him or was given to it for a low price, and it was damaged. And so he looked at that gun, and I don't know how old he was. I would imagine he's around 10 or 11, 12. And he decides that he's got to take that gun apart. And so he spends the time in prying apart the bent pieces and lays it out on the table and realizes that he could manufacture parts to replace that. And I think that's when he learned about the real workings of the gun. He had a brain that I think was excited thinking about guns. I think that's what he thought about a lot. And he also had a way of he could see how they worked. He had a genius for guns. I think he'd rather have been working on guns than been in school, but he realized that he needed a little bit of school, but he'd rather have been working in the shop than he would be educated. And Jonathan didn't place a real high value upon education. He taught his kids how to read, how to do simple math. Considering Jonathan himself, when he was back in Brushy Fork, there was no school, there was no church, there was nothing back in Brushy Fork for Jonathan to learn from. So Jonathan was mostly self-taught. And I think the same way that he thought his boys would teach themselves, which they did. Anyway, he had a mind that was inquisitive, and he wanted to learn more about guns and produce them.
I've referenced the writings today of some guy named Ron Schertz and Charles Scaliger, both who probably used as a reference the book that is sitting in front of us here called John M. Browning, American Gunmaker, published by John M.'s son, John Browning, and Kurt Gentry. But one of the, as you're describing John M. the way that he thought. I wrote this section down. Browning's secret to his success is best explained by an incident involving his brothers Ed and George. One day his brother George noticed that his brother Ed had abandoned the workshop where John was working furiously on a gun project. George asks, "Why aren't you working upstairs?" He replied, "Oh, John's stuck. He's swearing every little while. He doesn't know whether I'm there or not." And the other brother says, "That's too bad. I thought it was coming along fine." And he answers, "Don't worry. It won't be long now. John's so hot that something has to give pretty soon, and it won't be John." So seems like John had a real passion and did it until it was finished.
So it's an interesting situation. John is basically a shy person. He didn't like speaking in public. He basically didn't have a head for business too much. I mean, he had some, but his love was inventing guns. Now, Matt became the financial guy. He was great at running businesses. And so together is a story that I've been told, that together they formed the Browning Brothers. And it was J.M. and M.S., Browning Brothers. And they went up to the old shop. By then, Jonathan wasn't doing anything really with it. He was elderly. And they hauled down the big pieces that they needed down to a shop down in Ogden and set up business. And they involved their brothers in the business. So Ed, who is Jonathan Edmond, he was the mechanics part of the business. Matthew was the businessman, and John was basically the inventor. Thomas Samuel, who went by Sam, ran the Salt Lake business of Browning Brothers because they set up in Salt Lake too. And so he was doing the selling down there. So they involved a lot of their family, but the main owners of the business were Matt and John, and they filed the patents together. And so they started with producing a rifle, and I think they decided they didn't like being in the producing part. They wanted to sell the patents. But they were just out in the frontier. And there was no, I mean, their knowledge of law was slim. And one day a salesman from Winchester came and bought a secondhand rifle and brought it back to Winchester, and Winchester loved it. And they went out there, and they were prepared to offer him so much. And the boys kind of settled a little low. But to them, it was a ton of money.
Sure.
And eventually, Jonathan was always, as far as his standing, he was always affluent in the society. But John and Matt became wealthy in the society. And so the interesting part was that it was on John's brain. And he'd make little drawings on paper or on the back of a ammunition case. And he had all the tools, but basically it was all in his mind. He could see it. He could visualize it in his mind. And so he'd go to Ed, and he wouldn't bring blueprints or anything. He'd just say, "Ed, I want this, blah, 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 you know, this long. Make it a little longer there, you know." And Ed would make it. So all three brothers had special talents that formed the Browning Brothers. Now, I don't know if you know this, but my husband works for Browning in Mountain Green. And he's the only Browning there of Browning blood. Of course, he comes from Elizabeth Stalkup. We're not from John M.'s side.
Okay.
But we have a lot going on with Browning in
sure.
our lives. And so anyway, they're down in Ogden and they're starting to earn money, and their father is very pleased with them and how they're progressing in it. But the thing that we need to remember, that is, if Jonathan wasn't creating rifles and guns, and there wouldn't have been the John M.
Right.
I mean, he would have gone in some other area. And he was always encouraging him to, "You can do it better than that. You can do this." And John had the mind to do it. And they started the rifle club in the early days of Ogden. And they had the four Bs. There was Bigelow, Becker, and the two Brownings. And they were always at the Rifles. And so one day they were there, and John observed that there was a, as they fired the rifle, the grasses would move. And he started, he just created this idea in his mind, I can harness that energy. And they left and they went back and found a way to harness that energy. And that was a huge invention, a huge step in the progression of guns.
The gas-powered machine gun.
Yes.
Amazing.
Yes. And so it just shows you that he was thinking about guns all the time. It was in his blood, just like I do genealogy a lot, and it's in my blood.
At age 32, John was asked to go on a mission to Georgia.
Yes.
And so he fulfilled a successful mission. The story goes that he and his companion were in a sporting shop, taking a little break, I guess. And John picked up one of his rifles. It was a Winchester 87 repeating shotgun. And he handled it so well, the proprietor made some mention of it to the companion. And the companion says, well, Yaru, he invented it. Kind of an interesting story.
Yeah, and you have to remember that they'd been out on the road for days, and they probably looked like dirty and a little bit, you know. I mean, they probably weren't very dressed up like townspeople because they were out on the mission, and they had to rely on their own purse, without their purse, excuse me, and they had to rely on the people, the community, to provide for them. And so the guy was really – did not believe them. He just kind of gave them a look of disgust and put it back up and said, okay, get out.
But as you say, he was more of the inventor. He didn't want to be in the manufacturing business, and that's why he sold many, many of his designs and patents to Winchester, Colt, Remington. Many of the, in fact, even went overseas to a Belgium company and spent a lot of time with them.
Fabrique Nationale.
Yes, thank you. And when it came time that the U.S. entered World War I, he was really in a position to make a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
But something happened. What happened?
Okay, so John was very patriotic, and he could have earned a lot of money from selling the Army his inventions. And he did sell his patents to the Army, but he didn't collect – he collected a fraction of what they were worth. And he did that on purpose to support – he said, we could have been out there in the ditches if we were born a few years earlier. And this is my way of supporting my country. And Matthew was right there with him. A lot of times Matthew's left out of this equation. But to me, I don't think – John would have been successful without Matthew and Ed. I don't think that he would have been as successful because he was I don't think money mattered that much to him. I think if he had no money, he would have been just as happy. He was a family man. He was not into the riches of the world. I mean, he didn't want half of the things that were bestowed upon him, I don't think. And that's just my opinion. But I think he was proud of his accomplishments. But he did serve a mission, and it's interesting. All their activities in Ogden were centered around the church in that time period. And so he was raised to become a good Latter-day Saint. And he served a mission and completed it faithfully. The one thing that people say about the Browning brothers, which I think is a loud tribute to his parentage, is how honest they were. Everyone in the community admired both of them. They never did anything dishonest in their lives. Not that they were perfect, but they were raised to be good citizens, as all his children were. There's a couple of them that had a few problems, but on the whole, they were very, very good people. And I think that speaks volumes for Jonathan and his wives as to their parenting skills. And I think making them work probably helped him out quite a bit, too, in keeping him from being idle.
Had a big part in it.
Had a big part in it, too. And that was all Jonathan's plan. I mean, he knew what needed to happen, and it was probably the way he was raised.
John Moses was, I guess, working in Belgium when he died of a heart attack, as I understand it.
Yes.
And was sent back home on a ship and was received with military honors, basically.
Yes.
The Secretary of War at the time, Dwight Davis, gave him quite a tribute. He says, "It's not thought that any other individual has contributed so much to the national security of this country as Mr. Browning in the development of our machine guns and our automatic weapons to a state of military efficiency surpassing that of all nations." That's quite a tribute, not only to John, but to, like you say, his family.
Yeah, he was bestowed a prestigious award in Belgium. And I have one shot of his body laying in state, and it looks like you're burying a king.
Wow.
It's huge. And when Matt died, the president of the church spoke at his funeral. There's just both of them really contributed to the economy of, we're talking, you know, Jonathan contributed in wherever he lived, and his kids really helped the economy of Ogden. They were truly Ogdenites. They really supported. Now, Jonathan himself was a justice of the peace again in Ogden and was very civic-minded in Ogden, too.
So just to wrap it up here, Betsy Lee, why don't you give us kind of an overview of how you feel about Jonathan and his legacy, perhaps even as a family member, how you feel about
that? Well, it's strange because I have not a drop of Browning blood in me, and I claim it through marriage. And the reason I started it was so that my children could have example to look up to in their lives from their heritage. And it's amazing because I'm still finding things on Jonathan. I found an original document yesterday that I had never seen. And I've done this for 20 years. I've researched Jonathan for 20 years. And I created a CD of his and collected all the Browning pictures. Sometimes when you're doing research, you find the person isn't as good as you thought it was. But there's those times that the person lives up to his reputation. And that's how Jonathan was. I have three letters that I've been able to find that Jonathan himself signed. The first letter is about an issue in Weber Canyon, and he's writing Brigham Young. And it's the last paragraph that made me title my CD, Jonathan Browning, A Man of Honor, because he's talking to Brigham Young. He says, "Now, if you don't feel that would be for the public good, all I can make honorably, I want to assist to build up the kingdom of God. But if I cannot get it honorably before God and my brethren, I do not want it. I am, as ever, your brother and friend." And to me, that speaks volume. And in another letter, he's writing to D.H. Wells, and he's come up with this idea to defend the saints when they were coming in with Johnson's army. And he came up with a bazooka, pretty much for the church. They could create a bazooka to keep the army off. They never did it, but he was writing them to tell him he knew how to do it. And the third one is to his wife. And he writes to his wife, and he's upset that he's separated from him, and he's telling him to be patient. And he says, "I desire to be patient under all circumstances, that I can know that patience is a great virtue." And he admonishes his kids to continue to cultivate patience. And it seems like his whole life, he was trying to build up the kingdom of God. Once he learned about the gospel, from that point on, he never faltered till the day he died and breathed his last. And to me, that's enduring to the end. And he did it. And he was always trying to raise his kids as and continue to teach them good principles. It's things that we do now, probably by prayer and being close as a family and teaching them to love the prophet, teaching them about Joseph Smith and the Book of Mormon. Simple things that we do now can extremely influence our family in the future. And I think that's what I admire about him the most. It's not the guns. It's really not the riches. It's because they were good, honest, true family men. All him, the women in his life, and all of his children had a true love of God.
Very good. Thank you. We've been talking about the life of pioneer Jonathan Browning, a remarkable individual, with Betsy Lee Browning, family member and vice president of the Jonathan Browning Organization. Betsy Lee, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. I'm grateful to be here.